Iran's President Raisi and Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan highlight the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Russia says it's considering further steps in response to an attack on Nord Stream undersea gas pipelines, which Moscow blames on London. Police in South Korea admit their crowd control tactics on the night of the Halloween tragedy weren't enough. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. President Ibrahim Raisi has stressed Iran's stance that a dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Caucasus region should be resolved by regional players. Raisi was speaking on a joint presser with visiting Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan after the two held talks on expanding bilateral ties. The president added that any foreign interference in the Caucasus will only add to regional problems. Raisi said that peace and security in the region is of prime significance for Iran. He also talked about bilateral relations with Armenia. Raisi said that achieving the target trade of $3 billion with Armenia is possible if Tehran and Yerevan show determination. Pashinyan also echoed Raisi on the need for sustainable peace and security in the Caucasus region. Iran has slapped sanctions on 10 American officials and four entities over human rights violations and supporting terrorism. Here are some of those blacklisted individuals.
General Michael Eric Kurilla, Commander of U.S. Central Command. Lieutenant General Gregory Gillett, Deputy Commander of U.S. Central Command. Scott Dozermu, Commander of U.S. Air Base in Erbil. Anne Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. Major General Isaac Johnson, Jr., Commander of U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command.
The foreign ministry says that targeted individuals and entities interfered in Iran's internal affairs, instigated violence and riots, and committed economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Those on the blacklist include a U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, the CIA, and the U.S. National Guard. Over the past few weeks, the United States and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Iran over what they call crackdown on anti-government protests. Iran has dismissed the allegation and says it's dealing with foreign-backed rioters. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says that Washington will resort to military action if necessary to prevent the Islamic Republic from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Now, there are other tools, sanctions, pressure, and yes, as the president has said, if all other means fail as a last resort, he would keep the military option very clearly on the table if that's what it would take to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
The Malis dialed up anti-Iran rhetoric and military threat while speaking at an event organized by an American think tank, Carnegie Endowment. It clarified that there has been no movement on Washington rejoining the Iran nuclear deal since late August or early September. It said that the U.S. will not waste time on a deal if nothing is going to happen. The 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was left in tatters after Washington withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories, with the U.S. participating indirectly. But the talks were stalled over what Iran called U.S. excessive demands. Russian President Vladimir Putin has held a trilateral summit with leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan, and that's in the wake of tensions between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. In a joint statement, Baku and Yerevan agreed not to use force to resolve their dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Our correspondent has more from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the US and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO, and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another block of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for a compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Russia says it's considering further steps in response to what it claims of Britain's involvement in attacks on Nord Stream gas pipelines in September.
We also have information that Britain is involved in the sabotage against Nord Stream, or speaking Russian, the act of terrorism, in regards to vital energy infrastructure, and what's more, not Russian. It's very important to note that, but international energy infrastructure.
Peskov stressed that those actions against the gas pipeline should not be left unanswered. Britain's already denied Russian allegation. It says that Moscow is trying to, quote, distract from its military failures in Ukraine. Russian Defense Ministry said that British Navy personnel had been involved in attacks on its Black Sea fleet and Nord Stream explosions. Massive leaks and unprecedented damage to the pipelines were detected on September 26th. Russia and several European countries called the incident an act of sabotage. Later, Moscow accused Western countries of not allowing it to participate in the probe into the explosions. Now, Moscow extending a previous evacuation order in the Russia-controlled regions near Kherson as Ukrainian forces advance to recapture the southern city. Russian-installed officials say that evacuation order for civilians has expanded to 15 kilometers along the eastern bank of Dnipro River. Ukraine calls the move forced deportation of civilians, which amounts to a war crime. Russia says that evacuations are to protect civilians as Ukraine is preparing for a massive missile strike on a strategic hydroelectric plant in the region. It also accuses Ukraine of planning to use unconventional weapons. Russia captured the Kherson region in the early days of its military offensive. Kherson, along with three other regions, integrated into the Russian Federation following referendums in September. The Eurozone inflation has hit a record high again this month amid growing fears of recession and an energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine. We've discussed that issue in our News Review program. A Eurozone inflation soaring again to hit a record high this month, that amid growing fears of recession and energy crisis fueled by the war in Ukraine. According to data from Eurostat, consumer prices jumped by nearly 1% to 10.7% in October. That's driven by the rise in energy and food prices. The European Central Bank has been increasing rates to offset the soaring inflation. but a policy has failed to curb the surge in recent months. And that amid fears that a monetary policy would force the Eurozone economy into recession. Now, to get some insight on this, I'm inviting a couple of guests. Our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, is joining me from Brussels. Also with us is Greg Simons, who's a researcher with the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden. Good to see you, gentlemen. Now, Jerome, pretty bad situation there in terms of economy. Tell us what measure is the EU taking, the central bank? As I just said, it's not been able to stop this soaring inflation. So what's going to happen next?
That's right. Well, the efforts by the European Central Bank, there's no doubt they have failed. And you have business and consumer confidence is going rock bottom. More economists that you speak to are saying that we are heading for a deep recession, because if they can't bring down inflation, if they can't bring it down inflation by raising interest rates, then what more can they do? And secondly, it's just growing pressure on ordinary households, because the cost of living isn't coming down, and yet their rents are going up when landlords pass on interest rate hikes to their mortgages. And people who have their own mortgage, of course, it's going up every month. They've raised interest rates now at their last three meetings, the ECB, by 2%, which is an enormous hike. 0.75% was the last rise. They're meeting again on the 15th of December to increase rates again. But really, with the demand on energy, the main thing driving inflation is energy and the sanctions against Russia, trying to cut Russia off. And with demand for energy set to go up during the winter months, we're set to see inflation keep going up as well. And how are unions? A couple of days ago, I was speaking to your colleague Bardia, talking about the fact that, you know, unions will be coming out and will be calling for strikes because wages are not keeping up with inflation. Mm. Well, since then, for example, here in Belgium, the police have agreed to go on strike, one-day strike action on the 9th of November in 10 days' time. All police stations will be closed. And the firefighters here in Belgium are going on strike in December. We don't know the date yet. And, you know, we've seen strikes here in terms of anti-austerity strikes and protests where you had more than 100,000 workers on the streets, and I think that's where we're heading during the winter months when we see prices keep going up and people being unable to repay their home loans, etc. I think we're going to see huge numbers on the streets, not here obviously just in Belgium, but right across the 27 members of the European Union.
Well, naturally. Now, Greg, as Jerome put it rightly, you know, Europe is grappling with a plethora of issues, and that has been there even before the Ukraine war. Now, how, to what extent, let's say, is this Ukraine war contributing to the further worsening of the EU in terms of economy?
Well, I mean, you have the convergences of two man-made stupidities, essentially. Everyone seems to focus on the Ukraine war and how that contributes, but few remember that this already began before the war. And what was beginning before the war was this adherence to this green ideology that is reducing this fuels and sources of energy, traditional ones, for so-called green energy, but not having the capacity to keep the supply for the demand, which is necessary. So this was already beginning before the war. And that was owing to the ideology. But if we look at what's happening now, it's because Europe isn't acting like a sovereign political entity. They're doing the US bidding. They're engaging as objects in the United States' economic war. I mean, currently against Russia, and possibly soon they're going to join in on China as well, which is just going to exacerbate things even more.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Jerome Hughes in Brussels, Greg Simons in Uppsala. Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this newscast. South Korea promising a speedy inquiry into the recent Halloween crush in capital Seoul in an attempt to calm public anger over the deadly incident. In a parliamentary address, Interior Minister Lee Sang-min apologized to the public and pledged to make sure that such disasters won't happen again. has faced fierce criticism for stating the deployment of more police would not have prevented the tragedy. The police chief also acknowledged the police missteps that contributed to the incident.
We found out that there were lots of 112 calls before the accident about the seriousness of the place. The calls were about the emergencies telling the danger and urgency of the situation that large crowds had gathered before the accident occurred. However, we think the police response to the 112 calls was inadequate.
Authorities say that they had no guidelines to handle the expected large crowd. South Korea is observing a seven-day mourning period. The stampede took place as people marked their first mask-free Halloween in 3 years. They were crushed after those at the top of a sloped alley fell over others. The incident has killed 156 people. The dead are from South Korea and 14 other countries. Scores of more people were also injured, almost 30 of them critically. North Korea has called on the U.S. and South Korea to stop their joint large-scale military drills. It's warning that war games are a provocation that may draw more powerful follow-up measures. The foreign ministry says the situation on the peninsula has entered a serious confrontation phase due to, quote, reckless U.S.-South Korea military moves. The ministry warned that Washington and Seoul have to take the blame for all the consequences if they do not stop their military exercises all at once. The U.S. and South Korea began one of their largest joint military air drills on Monday. That will run until Friday and will feature around 240 warplanes. Washington and Seoul say that Pyongyang may be about to resume testing nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017, and that's why they're holding the exercises. But Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion. A man accused of breaking into U.S. House of Speaker Nancy Pelosi's mansion has been charged with attempted murder and attempted kidnapping of a public official. 42-year-old David DePape is scheduled to make his first court appearance on Tuesday. He was arrested from Pelosi's San Francisco home on Friday. DePape allegedly intended to tie up the powerful politician and break her kneecaps with a hammer. He also smashed the head of Pelosi's husband, leaving him unconscious. Assault with a deadly weapon, burglary, elder abuse, and threatening a public official are other charges against him. According to a court filing, the suspect forced the House Speaker to confess to, in his words, Democratic lies. A lead prosecutor has described the act as politically motivated. It occurred amid escalating political tensions ahead of midterm elections. Fears are growing over such violence. The election is due on 8th of November, will decide the control of Congress. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that the suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, was a serious event in the course of the Islamic Revolution and highly impacted the family members of the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini himself treated the event very calmly as if nothing had happened. Today, we are going to speak to you on the Imam's departure to Paris. Stay with us, please. As the family of Imam Khomeini was getting prepared for the first anniversary of Haj Aqa Mustafa's martyrdom, the Ba'athist regime in Iraq decided to expel the Imam. Imam Khomeini, however, was not intent to capitulate to the demands of the Iraqi regime. Thus, he made up his mind to go to Kuwait. But the Kuwaiti government was forced by the Iranian dictatorial regime to reject the Imam's request. Therefore, after a brief stay on the Kuwaiti border, Imam Khomeini consulted with Haj Ahmad and accepted to go to Paris. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, "The night when the Imam wanted to leave for Kuwait was a strange night. Everyone was at our home. Everywhere was quiet. We slept at 12. Nearly 2 hours later, the Imam woke up for midnight prayer. It was peculiar. As soon as the Imam got up, everyone got up except children, as if no one had slept. Imam Khomeini got up to do his routine night job, ritual, ablution, midnight prayer, supplication and recitation of Quran. At that night, everyone was performing midnight prayer. Ahmad went to inform the friends who were supposed to accompany the Imam to Kuwait. He found all of them from the alleys of Najaf. They too had either not slept the night or just had fearfully taken a rest for an hour. Everybody was ready. Ahmad asked the Imam, 'Shall we not go?' The Imam answered, 'A quarter is left to the due time.'" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, left Iraq without his wife and other women of his family. The women were supposed to stay in Najaf until conditions would become proper for joining the Imam. Lady Saghafi relates the story of the night when the Imam left them. "Everyone was doing something. I was preparing the foodstuff for the journey. Bread, cheese, walnut, and cuckoo. Imam Khomeini bid farewell to everyone. When it was my turn, he cast a deep look at me and said, 'I put you under God's care. It is nothing. We cannot disobey God. These people want to force me to give in. But pray that we move in the right way.' I let the Imam pass under the Quran and Ahmad followed him." She continues, "For 3 days, the workers outdoors thought that the Imam is at home. On the third day, when our Afghani worker understood that what happened, he wept so intensively. At first, I thought that they knew and was surprised as I saw no reaction from them. Then it was clear that they had not known. The house was plunged in silence. Everyone went to a corner. Some were crying quietly. Their pillows were plunged in tears, but there was no voice. Nobody had heard the sound of our hearts breaking. The departure of Imam Khomeini and the unknown future condition was very worrisome for his family, particularly for his wife. Nevertheless, some of their friends not only didn't help them to endure tough conditions better, but they added salt to their injury by censuring them. The Imam's wife recounts, when the Imam left Najaf for Kuwait and then Paris, some of the wives of ulema asked, "Why did the Imam do this? Isn't it a pity to leave the holy Najaf and go to the land of disbelief? How can one compare the divine neighborhood of Imam Ali with Paris, the land of debauchery and unfaith?" It was meaningless for them to see a source of emulation to go to France, as they didn't find it rational. For them, it was better to die in Najaf, even if it was with silence against the oppression, to living freely in Paris. Some of them thought that what made the Imam to go to Paris was his inattention to other sources of emulation, so that it would be said in history he acted differently to become conspicuous among others. Ms. Saghafi relates her last pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon them. "Any time that I went on pilgrimage of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl, I would ask them to accept me once more to visit them. I would pray and they would accept. But the last time I forgot to ask them my usual request, thus I didn't find the opportunity to visit them anymore." 10 days after Imam Khomeini's departure to Kuwait and Paris, the preparations were made for the trip of his wife and other members of the family. The Imam's wife says, "Upon the Imam's departure, we started collecting everything to join him after holding the first anniversary of my son's martyrdom. I had no sorrow except leaving my son. Ahmad telephoned me and told me to go to France with Hussein. The tickets were taken for 4 days later, and we spent 4 days to gather everything. We would spend the nights to bid farewell to the commander of the faithful and my son Mustafa. I couldn't go to Karbala anymore. On the 14th of Dhulqa'dah, we left Najaf for Paris. I and my grandson Hussein went to Paris and then to Nuffalo Chateau. Ahmad welcomed us at the airport. We had the lunch at Mr. Karim Khoda Panahi's home and went to the Imam in the afternoon. 3 days later, a house was taken for us. It was the house of Mr. Askari. It was the so-called bureau. The little appliances that had been prepared also belonged to the homeowner."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been an ongoing topic. The past two nights we have been looking at the components of an Islamic identity. We talked about the I-ness inside of us, the who-ness inside of us. But ultimately, the question of identity is a question when we answer the question of who are we. And I mentioned to all of you that within Islamic theology is a whole comprehensive talk about the I inside of us, that immaterial I, that ruh-e mujarrad, that's not bound by space or time, or is not found inside the physical world. And it is an I that we need to constantly work on, to build, to strengthen, to preserve. And one such way to do that was the talk from yesterday, which was about the power of our thoughts. And how sometimes the way we think defines who we are. And hopefully you didn't forget my sixth link chain. Fikr and mail, fa'il and khulq, malaka and thought, inshallah. That a thought can very easily become our actions, that can become our disposition, that can become somebody we are known as. And my purpose last night was to talk about the triggers of our thought, and to my young guys to understand the power of those triggers. Now, one point I wanted to make as a correction or an addition from last night was that I'm not asking any of you or myself to be surrounded by only the ma'sumeen or the infallible. Of course not. There will be moments where the negativity is inside of you. There's thoughts that are quite toxic, that are quite destructive in nature. Sometimes they enter into our thoughts. Sometimes we have a bad day, and sometimes we just want to shut the world off. I'm not saying to be a robot, nor am I being unrealistic to think that we always have to have positive thoughts. My only point yesterday was, do not underestimate the power of your thoughts. And where you're able now to kind of cultivate those planters of those seeds of thoughts, then choose those cultivators carefully. Be it your spouse, be it your friends, be it what you watch and what you listen to, all of that has an impact on who you are. And in tonight's discussion, I want to look at the idea that identity and the cultivation of it actually is a mind, body, and soul reality. The problem that I see, or the challenge I see inside of myself, and maybe inside of all of you, is that we have begun to kind of look at religion in general as only a spiritual reality. Submitting to a higher power, right? Even to the point where now today's lingo is the idea that, you know, if you talk about a higher power, there's even some sort of a refrain from mentioning the word God. God's been replaced to a higher power, a spiritual being. And, you know, one thing I have not kind of defined, because it does, you know, it doesn't have a clear-cut definition, is part of my title of the series was a postmodern era. Now, postmodernism is a concept, not a one-line definition. But to understand postmodernism is to understand modernism. And in the era of modernism, it was accepted that there was one clear-cut truth and one clear-cut path. In a postmodernist world, the idea is that all paths are equal. It's a very pluralistic approach. Everyone is right. There's no one absolute truth. There's no one religion or path that can claim to have monopoly of what is haq. And so it is a wide, liberal era that we live in, to the point where even when something is blatantly wrong, we can't speak out against it. Because that would make us intolerant. And intolerance is frowned upon. And one of the areas of this postmodernism, when it comes to religion, is has nothing to do with the physical. In fact, you know, there are PhDs written on the cultivation of Islamic identities. And a lot of the writers that I had read, they all talk about one of the most effective barriers that society now has placed in front of our kids to avoid this Islamic identity is to keep the religion only spiritual. It's between you and God. It's in your heart. What you do outside in terms of the external world and your body has nothing to do with your spirit. It's a very private thing. In fact, a lot of my youth say it's none of anyone's business how I dress, where I go, how I speak, what I wear. Nobody. It's between me and God. It's a very individualistic and fad girai, as they say in Farsi, concept. It's me, myself, and God. And as we know, and I've spoken about this many, many times, Islam is far from an individualistic religion. In fact, where there is an individualism and a communal, a collectivism discussion, it absolutely says to go down the collective. And so long as they are, whoever they are trying to pull our youth away from the path, they succeed in limiting religion to be nothing but a spiritual reality, they've succeeded. Because now what ends up happening, doesn't matter what I do to my body, how I show my body, where I go, what I listen to, what I drink, what I eat, hijab or no hijab, how I look at a non-mahram, none of that is connected to religion. It's me, it's my spirit, and that's all that matters. There's a whole movement out there, SBNR, spiritual but not religious. Whole movement. They have a whole website, they have a whole, absolutely. The idea that yes, I believe in a higher power, I'm not confined to organized religion. Because organized religion is for the churches and the synagogues and the masajid. It's for the priests and the rabbis and the imams. I'm good with God. I understand God. He's in my heart. That's all that matters. Whether or not that actually results in me living a physical life that resembles that religion is irrelevant. And this has to be addressed. The Islamic identity is mind, body, and soul. And there's an absolute interdependence and a codependence on these three elements. And inshallah, I'll present to you some discussions, some proofs from history, from the Qur'an, from hadith, that tell us that yes, absolutely, it's important for us to look the part, feel the part, and believe the part. Because, you know, discussions like modesty. Why does Islam get to define what modesty is? In terms of how a sister should dress, or how a brother should act. If I am wearing modest clothing, that's up to me. I can define that. As I mentioned a couple of nights ago, why do I have to pray the way he says? I meditate. All these discussions are happening more and more. And there are some of my youth who are bold and ask. There are some who internally kind of have these questions and they leave them there. And that's even more dangerous sometimes. They don't go out and actually clear up the doubts. Because the reality is that before even the spirit is even developed and the heart is even ready, it's the body that initially now begins the path of spirituality. Sometimes we have no idea as children. Some of my young kids in the audience, they fast because everyone else is fasting. They pray, they have no idea why they're bowing down, why they're prostrating, why it's two sujood, one ruku, no idea, but they're doing it.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلى الله عليه.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. With the continuation of the crimes of the Israeli regime against oppressed Palestinians in the occupied territories, almost all human rights organizations have acknowledged that these people are facing a racist and apartheid regime that increases its crimes and colonial measures day by day. Recently, some United Nations human rights officials and five former European ministers have labeled Israel as a racist and apartheid regime. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Monitor has more for us. The United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories says it will investigate apartheid charges against Israel, stoking serious fears among Zionist authorities that the probe would recognize the regime as apartheid due to its ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. The three members of the Commission said during a briefing at the United Nations in New York on Thursday, 27th of October, that future reports will investigate apartheid by Israel. They said the investigation has so far focused on the root causes of the conflict, which they ascribe to Israel's illegal presence in the occupied West Bank. Navi Pillay, a former United Nations human rights chief who chairs the Commission, called apartheid a manifestation of the occupation. Navi Pillay said, "We're focusing on the root cause, which is the occupation, and part of its lies, and part of it lies in apartheid." She added, "We will be coming to that. That's the beauty of this open-ended mandate. It gives us the scope." The United Nations Human Rights Council, Human Rights Watch, and other international human rights organizations have accused the Israeli regime of apartheid in the past 2 years. Earlier this year, reports emerged that the Israeli Foreign Ministry was planning a campaign to head off accusations of apartheid by the United Nations Commission. A leaked cable reportedly revealed Israeli officials were concerned about the damage the United Nations Commission's first report could do if it referred to Israel as an apartheid regime. The Commission presented its latest report to the United Nations General Assembly on Thursday, 27th of October. The 28-page report condemns the Israeli regime for violating international laws by making its control over the occupied West Bank permanent and by annexing Palestinian-owned land in the occupied city of Al-Quds and the West Bank, as well as the Syrian land of the Golan Heights. It also slams Israel for discriminatory policies against Arab citizens, stealing natural resources, and gender-based violence against Palestinian women. In March of 2021, former International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda announced in a statement the launch of war crimes investigation in the Palestinian territories, which have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The probe is expected to include the 2014 Israeli military onslaught against the Gaza Strip, the Great March of Return demonstrations in 2018, and the Israeli settlement expansion across the Palestinian lands, including eastern Al-Quds. Turkey's Anadolu news agency covers the same story from a different angle. A group of former European ministers have acknowledged that Israel's policies and practices against the Palestinians amount to the crime of apartheid and called on the international community to hold the Israeli occupation regime to account. The group, in a letter published in the French newspaper Le Monde, said, "We must acknowledge that Israel's policies against Palestinians amount to the crime of apartheid." The former ministers include Danish politician Mogens Liketoft, Finnish politician Erkki Sakari Tuomioja, Slovenian lawmaker Ivo Weigel, Hubert Vedrin, a French socialist politician, and member of the British House of Lords, Baroness Saida Hossein Warsi. The letter stressed, "We see no alternative but to acknowledge that Israel's policies and practices against the Palestinians living in the West Bank, eastern Al-Quds and Gaza amount to the crime of apartheid." The group argued that the international community's reluctance to hold Israel to account over its crimes poses a grave threat to the rules-based order which is claiming to defend innocent people under siege and occupation. The group said the international community has rallied behind the multilateralism and the need to adhere to international law and protect human rights. Indeed, it is the only way forward in an increasingly polarized global landscape. Referring to Israel's occupation of Palestine, the group added, "At the same time, we are reminded how the international community has too often remained silent and failed to act in the face of grave violations of international law and impunity for serious abuses in other contexts." They stressed that safeguarding the international legal order means applying principles uniformly and consistently. The letter slammed successive Western governments for failing to uphold the international community's consensus regarding the illegality and immorality of over five decades of Israeli occupation. Although this principle is said to form the backbone of European policy and governs its relationship with the Israeli regime, the apartheid regime has never faced any consequences for its myriad violations of international laws. The website of the Middle East Eye has also covered the same story. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories said in a report released to the public recently that Israel's actions against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amount to persecution. The United Nations Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, wrote, "Realizing the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination requires dismantling once and for all the Israeli settler colonial occupation and its apartheid practices." The report, dated 21st of September 2022, details Israeli effort to stamp out the Palestinian collective identity and sovereignty, noting the 13th of May 2022 attack by the Israeli military on Palestinian pallbearers carrying their national flag during the funeral of the murdered journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Francesca Albanese also documents the use of lethal force against journalists and humanitarian workers critical of Israel, along with the detention of Palestinian political leaders. The report discusses the recent case of Salah Hamouri, a French-Palestinian lawyer from the city of Al-Quds, who was detained without charges or trial since 7th of March 2022 on allegations of terrorism. According to the report, almost 4,500 Palestinians are currently detained, 730 of them without any charge and largely based on secret evidence. While Palestinian children as young as 12 have been victims of arbitrary arrest and detention, 500 to 700 Palestinian minors are held every year by the Israeli regime. Francesca Albanese critiqued efforts by regional states to normalize their ties with Israel, calling the peacemaking attempts ineffective because they have not focused their approaches on human rights, particularly the right to self-determination, and have overlooked the apartheid and the settler colonial underpinnings of the Israeli occupation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Those who remember Allah. This is the mark of someone who has an intellect. They remember Allah. Standing, sitting, and laying on their sides. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 191. In other words, in every circumstance, they remember. However, remembering Allah here does not refer to the mystical trance-like state of the dervish that some people crave, always remembering Allah, always chanting Hu. But that is not what we mean. We mean actively remembering God. But what is it to actively remember God such that His remembrance is counted as an act? How can one achieve this? And reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. Do you see? Those who have intellects, those who are truly wise, are those who ponder and think, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. And as they ponder on this, they say, whether inwardly in their hearts or outwardly with their tongues, Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. Immaculate are You. You have not created this without a purpose. You are too immaculate to have made this without a purpose. In other words, this is the most fundamental principle of their belief system or worldview.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Each and every worldview starts from a simple fact. We are here for some purpose. If you believe in God, you say you were created for a purpose. And if you do not believe in God, you say you have a purpose here. Do you see the most fundamental idea of a philosophy that is meant to inspire a way of life, whether for an individual or a society, is this: Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. He is a theist. He believes in God. So he says, Our Lord, You did not create heavens and the earth and all they contain for no reason. You are too immaculate and wise to do such a thing. Therefore, I have a moral responsibility. I must follow a path. I am but a speck among the wonders of the cosmos. But I am here for a reason. In this grand edifice, You have made a place for me and given me a purpose to fulfill. But I might disrupt the harmony of this system. Immaculate are You. So save us from the punishment of the fire. Whilst the fire of the resurrection is real, it is also a symbol of the fire of God's wrath, anger and retribution. End of the cosmos. You must pay attention to this because this is all a prelude so that we can apprehend the meaning of faith based on understanding from these verses.
Allah, I wanna thank You. I wanna thank You for all the things that You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.